Hello, thank you for joining for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong. In this podcast, I talk to authors about newly released books on Turkey and its neighbourhood. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. And check out show notes and other links that you may find interesting at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Remember, there's a special offer for Turkey Book Talk listeners, courtesy of Hearst Publishers. In that offer, you can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any one of five excellent books published by Hearst. Check it out via the address hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. That's hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. If you make a purchase through that deal, it's cheaper than Amazon, and it's also a good way to support this podcast. Books included on the list and available to purchase are written by authors who have featured on this podcast at some point. They include The Circassian, A Life of Eshref Bey, Late Ottoman Insurgent and Special Agent by Benjamin Fortner, The New Turkey and Its Discontents by Simon Waldman and Emre Çalışkan, The Poisoned Well, Empire and Its Legacy in the Middle East by Roger Hardy, Out of Nowhere, Syrian Kurds in Peace and War by Michael Gunter, and Jihad and Death, The Global Appeal of Islamic State by Olivier Roy. So to order any of those titles for a third off plus free delivery, visit the page for the offer, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com, and help support Turkey Book Talk. Another way to support, if you enjoy or benefit from this podcast, is through my Patreon account, which lets you make a small or large donation on a per episode basis. The standard donation is $3 per episode, but you can donate as much or as little as you want, and you can find details of that Patreon account through all the Turkey Book Talk pages. But let's get on with this latest episode. In it, I speak to Nigar Göksel, who is the Turkey director of the International Crisis Group and one of the authors of their recent report on Turkey's 33-year conflict with the PKK. The report is called Managing Turkey's PKK Conflict, The Case of Nusaybin, and it examines the issue through the situation in Nusaybin, which is a small Kurdish-majority town in Mardin province that has been particularly badly hit since the collapse of the peace process between the Turkish state and the PKK in summer 2015. A 134-day curfew was imposed in Nusaybin from March to July 2016 after militants dug trenches in the town to declare autonomy from the state. Fierce clashes ensued, with a death toll of at least 184, including 82 members of the security forces and 24 civilians. Six of the town centre's 15 neighbourhoods were completely destroyed, with 6,000 buildings demolished or heavily damaged. Around 30,000 people lost their homes, and the population dropped from around 120,000 to around 100,000. Like many others across the southeast, the local Nusaybin municipality has since been taken over by administrators appointed by the central government in place of the Kurdish-focused HDP's local affiliate, the DBP. A team from Crisis Group went to research the situation in Nusaybin, where they spoke to combatants on all sides, as well as ordinary locals. I started by asking Nigar Göksel about how they prepared the report.
So as Crisis Group, this is our eighth report on the PKK conflict. And what we tried to do is analyze from the field what the situation is after this intense urban fighting took place since July 2015, when the ceasefire collapsed between PKK and the Turkish state. There were a number of provinces, a number of districts in the southeast that were caught up in urban fighting after that, from July 2015 to June 2016. Diyarbakır Sur district, the center of Şırnak, the Cizren Silopi districts of Şırnak, Mardin, Nusaybin, where we concentrated on, and Yüksekova in Hakkari. And we went to the field and tried to understand how the local residents in particular had been impacted by the fighting, and where they were leaning in terms of support to PKK, fatigue, disillusionment, and where they stood with regard to the peace process. In March 2016, we'd written a report about the Sur district of Diyarbakır, and that was sort of fresh after the fighting had finished. And so one of the things that we wanted to look into more deeply in Nusaybin was how the reconstruction of the devastated neighborhoods was playing out. Because in Nusaybin, which is really a case study for us of the larger picture of what happened in this range of pro-Kurdish towns in the Turkish southeast, in Nusaybin, a curfew had been imposed between March and July 2016, when nearly 30,000 people of a 120,000 population lost their houses. And as a result, eventually, 6 of the 15 neighborhoods of this district were demolished completely. Casualties numbered around 199, at least. Those are the ones that we could confirm. And compensation schemes were playing out when we went there. So we were also trying to gauge whether the state was able to restore a sense of justice and its compensation schemes for the people that had been caught between the PKK and the Turkish state, essentially, in the fighting, because the civilians, that was one of the things that we picked up very distinctly. The civilians had felt very much that they were victims of a conflict being played out between PKK and the Turkish state. And even though they have strong support of the Kurdish movement, Nusaybin had received close to 80% of the vote in the local elections in 2014. They didn't very much appreciate the fact that PKK had brought the fighting to the urban districts and closed off their neighborhoods with trenches and barricades to prevent the Turkish state from entering. So yeah, that was the aim. That was why we chose Nusaybin. It's also on the border of Syria, right across Kamışlı in Syria. So there was also a regional component. We also were looking into the effect of the Syria war on the local population, how they see their future as it relates to Syria. Yeah, roughly that's how we started off.
And that's really the big difference between the clashes that broke out in 2015 after the peace process broke down and really decades before. This time they were really urban-based clashes. The PKK-linked militants had dug in to various neighborhoods in towns across the southeast, and that's why a lot of the images that were emerging were so dramatic. I mean, you look at pictures of Nusaybin and it almost looks like Syria at times. And you mentioned there this report comes 1 year after the one that you that Crisis Group wrote about Sur, which was another very badly hit district in Diyarbakir. What were the major differences and the similarities that you found in the two cases?
Well, of course, there's a time difference, and therefore some of the differences had to do with the period in which we wrote the Nusaybin report. When we wrote the Nusaybin report and conducted our research, the country was also in a different place, in that the coup attempt had been followed by an emergency rule. An emergency rule had enabled the dismissal of both at the national level of the HDP representatives, 14 of them at the time, and also HDP's sister party, DDP, which is the Democratic Regions Party, controlled most of the municipalities of the region. And both their mayors and their staff, I mean, much of their staff, like half of the staff of the Mardin municipality, for example, had also been dismissed from office. So there was a sense that the political channels were closed at the time that we wrote our report in Nusaybin. And that, of course, is fed into grievances and disillusionment about the peace process. And we tried to understand whether this is playing into PKK's hands, because when the political channels are closed, it becomes easier for PKK to legitimize their resort to violence among the society. And indeed, I mean, there's a percentage, there's a proportion of the society that does think like that. But we did feel in Nusaybin, at least, a very distinct sense of exhaustion with conflict, and a sense that they neither trusted the Turkish state nor did they approve of the PKK tactics, this bringing the war, bringing the conflict, as you said, to the urban districts, created a sense of bitterness towards PKK as well. But like I said, that bitterness hasn't translated into support of the Turkish state, no less because they don't feel like their grievances are being addressed in a deeper way, and that the rest of their representatives, the removal of representativeness, has not bode well for the appreciation of state policies towards the region. Of course, our report also came after the April presidential elections.
The referendum on shifting to the presidential system.
Excuse me, yes. And so we also factored in the support to the change of the constitution within the southeast. And it seems, of course, I mean, the state has played the line that there was a higher yes vote than AKP's, the vote that AKP had received in 2015 elections, November elections. This has been read into by the authorities as a as a shift to support the state more, but we found that somewhat overlooking both the distinct differences between the two elections and also the fact that there was much lower turnout in the elections for the constitution change than there had been in the parliamentary elections in 2015. So that we found that a little bit exaggerated. And by and large, the support for the Kurdish movement does not seem to have been reduced significantly as a result of the marginalization that's taken place at the national level and at the local level of the Kurdish movement.
Now, reporting from these kind of conflict zones like Nusaybin in the southeast is very rarely seen in the Turkish media today. Of course, part of the reason for that is because it's very difficult and rather dangerous, and the government is always looking to dissuade reporters and researchers from going there. What particular difficulties did you find while you were conducting the research for this report?
Well, of course, I mean, it's not just the dismissal of representatives, but the use of the anti-terror law to persecute academics, journalists who work on the region has created a silence in the debate, but also silence in protest. I mean, it is noted many times that people haven't gone out the street in the southeast to protest the dismissal of their mayors. But then they're afraid to. And the result, you know, what comes out of protesting is usually not much. And so there's a sense that there's no point in going out in the streets. We actually didn't run into hurdles in our research. The authorities, of course, as Crisis Group always does, we also talk to the authorities. We talk to both in Ankara and at the local level. We went to the governorate. We talked to the interior ministry. We talked to the urbanization ministry that's now in charge of reconstructing the devastated neighborhoods. And so we got their perspective as well. And as long as you give a voice and credit to the perspective of the state as well, I think conducting research in the region is not as difficult as is often imagined. But that also builds on our track record, though, of having for many years tried to find a middle ground and tried to argue for the interests of both the people on the ground that have contrary views from the state, but also acknowledge that the state has a legitimate position in restoring public order within the country. And the declarations of autonomy in some pockets of the southeast was really a tactic that was bound to fail, and it sacrificed to some degree the base that PKK relies on, in that it was provocative and it was bound to be met by a crackdown. At least the military operations were sort of expected as a result of that. So I think to answer your question, I think the fact that we talked to all sides at the same time made it much easier to function in the region as opposed to not engaging the state authorities.
And some of the really vivid parts of the report are where you're talking to kind of locals who are caught trapped in between these two sides. And one of the overwhelming senses that you get from reading the report really is this kind of sense of helplessness that comes across. You write that the Nusaybin residents have experienced what many first felt was a kind of PKK siege, and now it's really a military occupation by Ankara in their eyes. So after seeing this huge destruction and the suspension of rights under emergency rule and the removal of office of the local administration that was elected by them, there's just this sense of kind of not just fatigue but also hopelessness. Could you just talk about how the clashes have reflected on ordinary life in Nusaybin?
Well, I think the sense of hopelessness is also a factor of the regional dynamics, and that people feel that the Syria war and the geostrategic positioning of various actors is defining their future and the positions taken by both the Turkish state and PKK. So they think that it's more more top to bottom than bottom up. Their fate is determined by bigger dynamics. In Syria, PKK has felt in an ascendant position, like this is their window of opportunity, and less geared at coming to a compromise deal with the Turkish state. And the Turkish state has had a number of its own calculations as to why not to sit at the table with PKK, both regional and domestic. And so it's not about the people in the region and their demands, but rather a sort of power play. And that feels disempowering for people in the region, adding, of course, the fact that expressing positions is very difficult in the country. All these add up to make people feel very much like they're not in control of their future. I think we tried to highlight the perspective of women as well, because yes, we saw most distinctly this torn in between mode resonating among the mothers of the region who have children who were taking part in the militant activity on the one hand. So this being not knowing whether to stay there and support your child or try to convince your child to leave the neighborhood and go to some other province to stay there and help them somehow, cook for them. The sense that you're a civilian, but you could easily be deemed a militant if you're to stay in your house and try to protect your family was very apparent in the older generation of women in particular, because in the younger women actually. There are many women militants as well in the Kurdish movement. So I think it's less apparent among the younger women, but among the older women, the sense of being torn and having a segment of your family against PKK's actions and other segments of your family supporting them really created a dilemma. I think one that represents the larger identity crisis, I would say, that you can see in the region.
Kind of related to this question of hopelessness, I suppose, is this point that you mentioned in the report of various academic studies that show how PKK members' educational level is overwhelmingly below equivalent to primary school, and there are very, very few high school or university graduates who end up joining the PKK. And of course, with the kind of rising unemployment in the region and the huge destruction that's been wrought in Nusaybin, that brings the risk of further PKK recruitment, I suppose, among these kind of hopeless classes. Could you just talk about that aspect a bit? It gets overlooked, I suppose, at times, but this sense that there's something else there, kind of not pushing people towards the PKK, but that can perhaps explain recruitment in some senses.
On the one hand, you're right. On the one hand, the grievances are compounded by a sense of not having alternatives to reasonably good life conditions. On the other hand, I think the opposite is more true, in that the middle class has grown in the region, and people's expectation for a better life for their children has risen. Taking advantage of the services that the state offers, health, education, and whatnot, and its desire not to lose what you've already gained, also seems to be a very strong trend, which of course potentially makes PKK recruitment more difficult, because I think compared to the 1990s, people do have a taste of a better life, and they have experienced this period of no conflict in which the economy was picking up, and state services, when it comes to health and education in particular, have improved considerably. And what the state has been banking on is that they can win over hearts and minds by providing the prospects for a better life. And that includes better infrastructure. And that's one of the things that we did see the state was doing relatively well, and that trying to meet the material needs of the locals is distinct. There's an effort there. It's not perfect. It's delayed. There are problems, administrative problems, but it's there. The infrastructure, they're trying to provide better infrastructure, reconstruct houses, give people choices of what kind of house they want to live in. You can either choose a standalone house or an apartment flat, or you can choose to live in another province. Again, it's sort of state-subsidized housing complexes. There was a real effort to provide social aid, rent aid, compensation for belongings. The problem, though, is that, of course, this is important for an important segment of the society, but it's not enough to win hearts and minds. People want a sense of security, which they can either get from siding with PKK or from the Turkish state, and so this sort of projection of power is important. They want economic livelihood, but they also want an acknowledgement of their grievances, for impunity to be addressed, for the history of misconduct to be uncovered the restoration of social dynamism, which of course requires some type of independence. And they want certain rights, long-running rights demands to be addressed. And this is mother tongue education comes at the forefront of that. Also decentralization. There are certain rights that have been demanded for many years, which have been the source of the conflict in many senses, which they want to see addressed. And as long as that's not taking place, it's hard to win over the society with purely material gestures and policies. Another thing that we observed was that you can build infrastructure and you can build houses, but as long as jobs are not being created, there's just so much that's going to work. And the region is suffering a lot by the closure of the border with Syria. The trade that used to be conducted, just simple suitcase trade, let's say, has been stalled now that the border gates are closed. And so we saw that the businesses, in particular in Nusaybin, were suffering significantly. The small shops are not able to keep themselves afloat, and particularly the compensation for shop owners that lost their whose shops had been destroyed really felt like it was not, they didn't have a fair compensation for their losses. So there were on the one hand material group grievances, but also non-material, symbolic, identity-related grievances that continue to plague Nusaybin. And I think that's more or less representative for many of the other districts in the region that have experienced similar cycles of violence since July 2015.
You talk there about the state services that the central government has tried to develop in the administrations that have been taken over in places like Nusaybin. But on the other hand, one of the kind of relatively little known aspects that you talk about also in this report is how services that were previously provided by the DBP, Kurdish Movement Local Government, there was many services that were directed at helping local women, and these have been severely cut back since these local administrations were taken over by Ankara. Could you just talk a bit about this aspect? I don't think many listeners will be too aware of these services and how they've been changed in recent months.
Well, the Kurdish movement, both the national level party, HDP, and the local, its sister party, the local level, DPP, have really put a lot of investment into women. There's a gender quota in the party. That's why there's co-mayors everywhere. It's not just mayors. There's not one man, one woman. And they've also, at the local level, established a lot of institutions in the municipalities and also outside the municipalities to empower women, to teach them skills, to give them a place to apply when they face domestic violence, and to integrate them into public life. And this is really an effort to also counter overcome the traditions of the region, in which essentially it was a very conservative region. So it's been an effort to transform the gender inequalities of the region. Now, in the appointment of new employees in the municipalities after the removal of so many of the people that were hired by the Kurdish movement, that this drive has not been taken into consideration. Many of these institutions that were catering to the women of the region have been shut down in the staffing of the municipalities after the dismissals. This women's perspective has not been taken into consideration, and therefore you find that women of the region do not really have trusted counterparts to talk to where they used to. And that's a significant problem in our view, because particularly in these conflict-ridden areas, domestic violence can also increase. Of course, you have other problems that are hiked, particularly for women in these kind of circumstances. And just when the need is highest, in a sense, they have less resort. And this trust component is very important as well. There's a trust deficit. So if a woman in the region goes and complains about a family member that's been abusing her to a Turkish state representative. This is also a betrayal of her identity, of her allegiance to the Kurdish movement. So you find it much harder for women to go and talk to a state employee in the region about her problems, as opposed to if it was somebody who was trusted, who she knew, who came from, who they elected, and who was of the neighborhood from the people. So we observed that women felt like they had no channels anymore. And this was already something that was pretty progressive in that region, to set up these kind of institutions. It's also not in line with the alleged aim to restore public order, because you can restore public order and safety, but you don't have to at the same time erode an identity-related progress that people of these localities have been developing ever since they were able to be represented by members of the Kurdish movement. So that was, we felt like that had gone a step beyond what was necessary and legitimate when it comes to the state's precautions, let's say, to prevent PKK mobilization. The removal of the municipality staff was justified on the basis of links that they had to PKK. However, we felt like there needed to be more consideration of the ideological and identity-related priorities of the people of the region in the staffing and sort of decision-making process. It needs to be a little more inclusive and more taking into consideration the value-based preferences of the people. Another issue related to women is that in the region, it's particularly women who often were not in the past sent to Turkish state schools. And so, relatively speaking, the men have an easier time functioning in Turkish, particularly the older generation I'm talking about, whereas older Kurdish women can often not know Turkish. The Turkish language, yeah. Yes. And so when you replace a significant proportion of the municipality staff with state appointees, or the state appointees start hiring their own cadres, the ability to use Kurdish in the municipality courses drops significantly. And this has impacted women in more serious ways than it has men, particularly, as I said, older generation women who don't feel comfortable, who actually don't know Turkish enough to explain their problems in Turkish.
I just want to go back a bit as well to the period before the peace process collapsed, because there's a question about this line kind of pushed by the government that we've heard recently that FETÖ or Gülen-linked cadres were kind of responsible, they say, for allowing the PKK to build up militarily in the southeast and to kind of prepare for the declarations of autonomy that they did in urban areas with trenches and whatnot. I suppose it's a kind of predictable line that we would hear from them, but do you think there's any merit at all in that argument?
Of course, we can only reflect what we've heard from the field, but it does seem that there was at least a hierarchy and command control problem within the police, the interior ministry more broadly, and the military, and that there was a trust problem, or there is in retrospect, as to whether the alleged FETÖ linked individuals in the state security forces, but also other institutions, were actually conveying accurate information to their superiors. Maybe they were creating the grounds for the conflict to escalate more. When you talk to the Kurdish movement, they say, of course not, in that ideologically they're so different, and so at odds, in fact, and historically as well, that kind of collaboration would not be the case. Of course, it's not collaboration per se, but tactically, did they feed into each other, the sort of two different organizations that were both mobilizing against the authorities in Ankara? We have heard various accounts from the field that raise questions, let's say. The issue is more that it's hard to, of course, prove anything at this point, because the debate is also so curtailed, and that even raising these kind of issues or contradicting these subjects can be very sensitive. So I think it'll take some time before anybody is able to confirm or discount these kind of arguments. At the time being, though, it has convinced a significant proportion of the society, at least. And that in itself means something, and that the FETÖ structures are alleged to have played a role in standing by, in particular, when the tensions were increasing, when the trenches and barricades were being built. There was a period when the Turkish state could have taken precautionary measures, and they didn't. There are two different reasons that are often accounted. And one is that we had a peace process ongoing, and the assumption was there's no point in disrupting that by cracking down. And the other argument is that the extent of the mobilization by PKK was covered up by people that were staffed in the state institutions that were not, that had ulterior motives. I think it's too early to come to a conclusion, but we did note that eventually, while around 10% of the police were dismissed from their profession around the country, it was 20% in the southeast region. So clearly there's a sense that the proportion was higher of people that were connected to this network in those regions than otherwise. And that's also a result of the fact that this traditional state practice is to exile, in quotations, disloyal cadres to the southeast because the living conditions are worse there. And so there was a period, it seems, where there was a distrust towards those certain people and they were sent to the southeast, which is very counterproductive when you think about it. But it was a mistake that they say that they made at the time. As I said, I think it will take time to be able to substantiate that argument. But it's out there, and in a sense, it's something that serves as a scapegoat as well.
You talk in the report about how Ankara has often tried to kind of nurture Kurdish actors without ties to the PKK, empowering alternative Kurdish actors in a kind of move to drive a wedge between the Kurdish national movement and its supporters. So it kind of mobilizes a lot of more conservative clan base links locally, as well as kind of networks around village guards, etc. And there's also the Hudapa, which is a kind of conservative Islamist Kurdish party that many people speculate can become a kind of more important actor as a kind of government proxy on the ground, perhaps. They also, of course, supported the presidential system in the referendum in April. Could you just talk a bit about this strategy? What do these kind of moves involve, and do you think they can be developed by the government?
I think this is a cycle that's a pattern that we've seen in the past as well, where the Turkish state in many different times has tried to foster alternative Kurdish actors. Hudapa is a significant one right now, and there's a lot of speculation in the region that they're being also granted economic tenders and besides political support. There's a village guard system has obviously been pumped more recently. There's a higher number of village guards now that are being recruited. The leaders of clans, of sort of tribal families, feel like they might have a window of opportunity to be empowered more. And there's also this Barzani factor where, you know, this sympathy that may be felt among some Kurds in the region towards Barzani is seen as an opportunity to foster anti-PKK mobilization. I mean, it seems like the social base for this kind of the creation of an alternative is not very strong, in that winning over the supporters of the Kurdish movement via these actors is not likely. You may be able to mobilize the other Kurds who also already vote for AKP, but you know, are they going to switch? Are the supporters of HDP or the sympathizers of PKK going to switch sides and take part in some kind of a coalition that would be formed by these kind of actors? We didn't really pick up the sense that this would happen. The sort of demands that you hear from supporters of the Kurdish movement with regard to rights and with regard to their grievances in the past are not represented by these parties, and therefore you can't really come to a solution with parties, with actors that don't have the same demands that you've been voicing. So it doesn't seem like it's going to fundamentally change the dynamics of the conflict. And what we've been consistently saying as Crisis Group is that there are two different tracks that need to be pursued for a durable peace. And one is to resume talks with PKK. But on a separate track, the long-running rights demands of the Kurds need to be addressed. Everything from, again, decentralization, mother tongue education, the cleansing of ethnic references from the constitution, stronger representation representation, which at the time we said would require a lower electoral threshold, but that obviously is not sufficient when you look at the scene today, and the reform of anti-terror laws. So, you know, if there's a conversation with these actors, with other Kurds about these rights demands, that's fine. But that doesn't mean that that PKK can be marginalized to the point that it can be dismissed, and that we still think that returning to the table with PKK will be for a sustainable peace.
That was Nigar Gökçel. Thank you very much to her. I put a link to the report available in English and Turkish up at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com, so check it out there. Don't forget, Turkey Book Talk listeners can get a 33% discount plus free delivery on any of 5 books from Hearst Publishers as part of a special offer. To check out the books available and to order using that discount, buying a book and supporting this podcast at the same time, visit the special page for the deal, hearstpublishers.bigcartel.com. Also remember to rate or review this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast, which helps flag it up for other potential listeners. Follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes. Email recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And finally, if you enjoy this podcast and you want to support it, you can do so via my Patreon account, donating on a per episode basis. Many thanks to current supporters, Celia Jocelyn Kerslake, Michelle Zimmer, Jan Marcus Vommel, Steve Bryant, and Aaron Ataman. But until we meet again in a couple of weeks, thanks very much for listening.